Professor Jay Ellis is an associate professor in the Faculty of Law and the School of Environment at McGill University, and a Hydro-Quebec Sustainable Development Scholar. Professor Ellis teaches and conducts research in the fields of public international law, international environmental law, and global environmental politics.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is going to be quite a change of pace. I hope that it won't be perceived as too much of a diversion from what has obviously been a very passionate and a very interesting debate. I'm taking many steps back here to talk about corporate-sponsored research at McGill and in universities more generally. You already have one of the most important pieces of information in your hands. I am a Hydro-Quebec Sustainable Development Law scholar. I am obviously a corporately funded scholar. That's something that obviously you need to know as you're listening to my remarks over the course of this afternoon. I'm happy to say that my experience so far has been relatively uneventful. I'm drawing on that experience in my remarks today, but also drawing a lot on my reflections about this position, which admittedly has its awkward moments, to say the least. And I'm very grateful for this opportunity to pursue that reflection in a more systematic way, and also very grateful for the opportunity to present the fruits of that reflection to this group today. So my scholarship, as you've heard a little bit, is focused on environment. I do work with sustainable development, usually at the international or the transnational level. It so happens that my scholarship is pitched at a fairly theoretical or conceptual level. I do empirical work. I do relatively little empirical work that has to do with the Canadian legal or policy context, mostly, as I said, at the international or the transnational level. So the points of intersection between Hydro-Quebec's activities and my activities are not very many. Now, that may be for the good. It may create some space for me, but I'll leave that to you to judge. Now, obviously, the center of our analysis here is the concept of academic freedom. I'd just like to begin by putting a few key words on the table. This is by no means an exhaustive list, but let's start with integrity, trust, confidence. These are words that show up an enormous amount in McGill's policies regarding funded research, research ethics in general, and in particular, conflict of interest. On the other side of the ledger, we have terms like conflict of interest. Obviously, for obvious and very important reasons, conflicts of interest are at the heart of McGill's policy with respect to research. But I'd like to mention a couple of other key terms that I think we should bear in mind. These include influence, constraint, pressure. Not necessarily words that will show up in the policies, but that do definitely manifest themselves in all kinds of conversations we have at McGill and in the broader community around the role of the university. Now, it seems to me that the terms integrity, trust, and confidence are linked in very important ways to a further concept that I'd like to put on the table and which I've heard evoked in the last panel, namely rigor. So if a scholar is pursuing scholarship in a rigorous fashion, then we can have confidence in that scholarship, in that scholar. We can trust the scholar. We can view that scholar as being someone with integrity. Rules about conflicts of interest, about undue pressures, about undue influence, and so on and so forth, are, of course, in place to make it possible for scholars to pursue rigorous scholarship. It seems to me that there's a bit of a dialectic between academic freedom and rigor. Obviously, academic freedom exists as a concept, as a principle, in order to make it possible for scholars to produce rigorous scholarship. But I think there's a movement in the other direction as well. We beneficiaries of academic freedom, which I would like to frame as a right rather than a privilege, but even if it is a right, we beneficiaries of that right have obviously important responsibilities. We have, in particular, the responsibility to produce rigorous scholarship. I don't think that any of that is news for anyone in this room. Now, when it comes to funding relationships of any stripe, but more in particular, relationships between universities and researchers on the one hand and corporations on the other, I think that it does us all a good deal of a benefit to recognize the strategic nature of these relationships. Yes, it's absolutely true that all of the players in these relationships are interested in contributions to knowledge. But I think that that interest is pitched at such a high level of generality that it's not actually all of that useful to us to understand what our respective roles, responsibilities are, how to carry out rigorous scholarship. Contribution to knowledge is, I guess, too general a term to be more than an aspirational norm, and we need to be much more specific about what that means. Now let me talk about some of the other interests that are at play in this relationship. Obviously, corporations are bound to be interested in producing particular kinds of knowledge, useful knowledge, knowledge that is useful to them. I would always assume that it's useful to corporations to understand where they're going wrong, just as much as it's useful for them to understand how to pursue their own interests. And also, I think corporations who fund research, especially the kind of research that's done at the law faculty, are one of three Hydro-Quebec scholars, is essentially philanthropic. I think that we all hope that that's the case, that corporations are interested in entering into relationships with universities because they want to be seen to be allied with the university, with this project that is contribution to knowledge, with this project that is academic freedom. But it may not always be the case. Now let's think about the institutional reasons for seeking out and accepting corporate funding. I think, again, they're fairly obvious. Procuring and providing resources to the university and to individual researchers. Obviously, this is extremely important. And the university administration has a very special role in digging out these sources of funding, especially in the current economic and funding climate under which universities, in particular in Quebec, are operating. As for the researcher, yes, of course, we all want to make contributions to knowledge. Yes, we have projects, specific research projects, that cost money to move forward, and we need funding in order to move these forward. But in addition, and we all have to admit it and accept it, we're interested in our professional advancement. We're interested in our own contributions, in getting our work published, in having our name associated with contributions to knowledge. So on the one hand, we have this normative language, academic freedom, integrity, trust, confidence, rigor. And on the other hand, we have a strategic relationship among three partners that are all pursuing their own objectives. There is a good deal of overlap among those objectives, of course. If not, these agreements would probably not be reached. But to the extent that we can acknowledge the strategic nature of the relationships and the differences in objectives that are being pursued within those relationships, I think that we put ourselves in good stead to at least be much more aware of potential pitfalls and dangers. Now I want to turn to the question of communication, which I think to be at the core of much of what's being discussed today. Now first let me introduce the cast of characters. I've already mentioned the researcher, I've mentioned the university administration, and I've mentioned corporations that fund research. But let me also introduce other members of the university community. So my colleagues, for example, professors and students, potential corporate donors, which the university administration is certainly going to have its eye on in managing relationships between researchers and corporations, and finally, obviously, the broader community, which is supposed to be served in one way or another by the work that researchers at universities do. Now, all of these different actors with pursuing their own agenda, having their own strategic interests, having their own aspirational goals, need to communicate with one another. And I think that it will come as no surprise to you when I say that they're often speaking very different languages. They're coming from very different perspectives. Even as between university administrators and researchers, there are differences in alignments of interest. That, again, probably comes as no surprise to anybody in the room. But let me talk a little bit more about why these communications can be so difficult. Now, the main reason, I think, for the difficulty is because what it is that we are talking about is a very difficult concept to get across. At bottom, what we're talking about is what universities are for. And I think that while there are strong understandings within universities about what universities are for, I don't think that we as an institution, I mean as the institution of higher learning, do a particularly good job at communicating that, in particular to the broader public. So, for example, when we defend our right to academic freedom, it often sounds as if we're defending our right to do whatever we damn well please with the taxpayers' resources. And I will admit it, oftentimes the questions that we're pursuing are awfully esoteric. And oftentimes I and my colleagues can sometimes adopt an inappropriate attitude towards questions like, is this useful? What purpose does this serve? But ultimately, this is precisely the message that we need to be communicating to corporations, yes, but also to the wider community. What are we here for? What are we doing? Now, I think that members of the university are probably all in a certain amount of agreement that the university has a special mission, a mission that could be accomplished elsewhere in society through other institutions, that is to say, contribution to knowledge. But the university is special because it is particularly well suited to make these kinds of contributions to knowledge. Now, in a lot of fields where there is a reasonably close relationship between basic and applied research, I think that this message of the importance of academic freedom, the special nature of universities, is not quite so difficult to get across. Now, I don't work in a faculty of science, a faculty of engineering, a faculty of medicine, the kinds of places that I have in mind when I'm drawing this somewhat closer connection between basic and applied research. Certainly, where I come from, a professional school, there is, again, it's a little bit easier to tell the story about why our academic scholarly research is useful, if not directly and immediately, then at least at a few steps removed. But when we move into much of the kind of scholarship that's taking place, in particular here at the Faculty of Law at McGill, in faculties of law around the country, but also in the more qualitative social sciences, and most certainly in the humanities, I think it becomes a little bit harder for us, for university administrators, for this community, to make the case for supporting the special role of universities. Because it becomes harder to understand the link between what in the sciences, in engineering, in medicine, in a lot of disciplines, is understood to be the distinction between basic and applied research. So why do basic research? Well, pretty much any child who has had a bit of an acquaintance with the history of science has heard all kinds of stories about serendipitous discoveries, about the ultimate usefulness of the pursuit of knowledge for knowledge's sake. So Newton and his apple, just following, running down rabbit holes and seeing what's there, pursuing lines of inquiry without any particular attention to what end is going to be served in the fairly near future. And of course, academics know how difficult it can be to explain to taxpayers, to our relatives around the Thanksgiving table, to our students, sometimes to university administrators, and certainly to funders, why it is that we ought to be off studying 17th century literature or the links between alchemy and science or whatever it is that we're doing in our day-to-day lives. But I think we do need to be able to tell that story and tell it convincingly so that we can explain to the world beyond the university, but also to members of our own community, and I'm thinking in particular of our students, why it is that we get to travel in these circles, why it is that we get to immerse ourselves in these obscure bodies of literature, why it is that we get to do this for a living. And I think that we do have to recognize that it is a fairly privileged position that we're in. So we are talking then about the purpose of the university. We're talking about the purpose of academic freedom. And it can be, as I've already said, extremely difficult for us to do that and to do it convincingly. So I think that that is part of the reason why this strategic relationship that I've described among researchers, university administration, and corporations is really fraught with difficulty. Not only are we all pursuing our own agenda, our own objectives, but we have language and conceptual maps to explain what we're doing and why it's useful and why it's important that are very difficult for others to read. Now, certainly it can be particularly difficult, I think, to explain to a corporate donor why it would be important to fund research on something like democratic structures in transnational law or something along those lines. But somehow somebody managed to do it, and here I am. Now let me turn to what some of the fruits of my reflection over the last few years as a corporate-funded researcher. What do I need? I'm going to be utterly selfish about this right now. In addition to money and time and academic freedom, I need a couple of things, and I'm going to sum them up using the keywords clarity and independence. I'm putting independence second simply because I think it's pretty damn obvious, whereas I actually think that clarity probably plays a much more important role. I've said that a lot of the difficulties in this strategic relationship have to do with difficulties of communication, so it seems to me that clarity of communication is a good place to start. Now, if we assume, and I think we might as well assume, that it's not possible for all of the players in these relationships, university administrators, the corporation, the researcher, to be on precisely the same page and to all be pursuing precisely the same objectives, then let's talk about how we can set up communicative structures amongst these different players to protect the values that we want to protect: rigor, academic freedom, independence, and so forth. Now, here are a couple of obvious ones. The researcher needs to understand, the corporation needs to understand, the university needs to understand what's the scope of the research. So what is the researcher going to be working on? And I think it's also pretty obvious that if that scope is defined quite broadly, so much the better. If the research comes to be too guided, too focused on specific research questions, we're probably in a different province, namely partnerships between researchers and corporate R&D departments, for example, where the researchers take their hats off as university researchers and take up contracts with corporations. But if we're talking about a very broad field of study, and if the corporation is convinced to accept that somehow this contribution to general basic knowledge that a researcher is able to make are going to be useful in some way, if not to the corporation tomorrow, then at least to the broader environment in which the corporation is operating, then certainly I think that the researcher will have a certain amount of latitude. The pressures, the influences will be lessened. The range of items funded, again, that's a very obvious one. We need to know what we get to spend the money on. That needs to be on the table, and it is. I mean, these things are taken care of. University administrators are very good at making sure that these things are understood well. But let me mention a couple of other places where I think some improvements could usefully be made. Based on my own limited experience and on conversations with others that are in a situation similar to mine, and also based on conversations with people who are not in a situation similar to mine, my colleagues, for example, who look on this Hadra-Quebec scholarship with a certain degree of healthy skepticism. Now, the first one is interlocutors. So we've got this complicated strategic relationship. We've got this extremely complicated message that needs to be passed and needs to be understood at some level. So I think that one of the things that the researcher needs, and it will be extremely useful for all of the members in the partnership, in the relationship, is clarity about who the interlocutors are. So when is it, and under what conditions, is it that employees of the corporation speak directly to the researcher? Who in the corporation speaks directly to the researcher? When the researcher has questions or issues or difficulties, who in the university does the researcher speak to? A lot of times people who receive this funding are very savvy, very politically astute, have been involved in research, including funded research for many, many years, and understand the pitfalls and the difficulties. And any junior scholar, I think, is perfectly capable of understanding something like conflict of interest. But what about influence, pressure, constraint? I think that the researcher needs to make sure that there are interlocutors in the university who understand in their bones academic freedom and who are able to provide some guidance to the researcher when there are questions or problems, regardless of where those questions arise. So we need then to know whom we are to speak to at the corporation, who we are to speak to at the university. And in addition, I think it's very helpful for us to understand how the lines of communication between the university and the corporation operate. These can often, very often, from the point of view of the researcher, be utterly opaque. Now, certainly, if we want to, we can find out more about it. If we investigate, we can learn much more about who it is who is speaking on our behalf, who are the different actors, the offices, the officers of the university who are speaking to members of the corporation about our research funding, about our research. But I think it would be very helpful for the university administrators to make sure that the researcher understands how these lines of communication function, what kinds of messages are being passed, what understandings are arrived at about our role as researchers, about the role of the corporation as funder, the role of the university, and so forth. Another thing that we definitely need a good deal of clarity on, and that is actually very well understood by the federal and provincial funding agencies, is the reporting structure. Now, I think that any corporation that departs from the standards that have been set on reporting by the provincial and federal agencies may be running into some difficulties. Serious questions are going to be asked about why a researcher is being required to produce a certain kind of report for a corporate funder that is not being asked to produce for a provincial or federal funder. So, for example, the standard seems to be something along the lines of an annual report regarding the funds that are spent and the items on which they are spent. That, I think, is really a bottom line. It's necessary for the corporation, for the university, for everybody who is involved to understand that the funds are not being spent on trips to the spa or all those things that are actually quite essential to research if you think about it, but often aren't seen that way in the wider world. In addition, the difference between applying for funding, demonstrating that one deserves the funding and that one has a high likelihood of doing something really useful with the funding, on the one hand, and explaining what one is doing, on the other. Now, the federal provincial agencies have struck the balance in the following way. When you're done, let us know how it went. Tell us what you did, show us your publications, tell us about the conferences that you went to, and basically justify your existence. Explain to us why this was a good investment. But for obvious reasons, you do this at the end of the day. And I think that that concerns may be raised if the researcher is asked to do this reporting along the way. Now, these concerns may not be at all well-founded. But, again, this is one of those issues of communication problems. We as researchers are used to a certain structure of reporting, an enormous amount of freedom while we're going through the process, whereas corporations, of course, are used to checking in, benchmarking, finding out how things are going, checking in on the progress. So the routines of reporting are, I think, completely different in the two cultures. And as soon as we identify this cultural clash, and as soon as we have somebody on our behalf able to tell this complicated story about academic freedom to our corporate funders, well, a little bit of the pressure will be alleviated. Many of the concerns will potentially be alleviated. Now, I want to talk a little bit about other expectations and tell a rather banal story, a hypothetical. We lawyers like our hypotheticals. Now, let me use the example of an event that's being organized with funding. Fairly intimate, highly academic event, a bunch of, 10 or 15 or 20 talking heads discussing Foucault and 15th century history or whatever it is we do, gathered around a table. Now, in the context of an individual donor, a private citizen who has donated money to a faculty or to a researcher to realize a particular project or to carry out a particular program of research, it would be considered the most simple and the most basic common courtesy to invite the donor or a member of his or her family to the event, to meet the people who are involved in the research, to talk to them a little bit, to congratulate them on their project, to learn a little bit about what they're doing. It would seem inappropriate in the extreme to exclude a private donor from such an event if he or she is interested in attending and just seeing how things are going. But it may very well be that the picture looks very different from the point of view of the corporate-funded researcher. So there is, I think, an important difference in that kind of context. How does it look in a rather intimate, highly academic, highly theoretical workshop, let's just take that as an example, if the corporate funder shows up and talks a little bit about all the wonderful things that it's doing with respect to X, Y, and Z? Now, from the corporate point of view, this may seem like common courtesy. Why would I not come to this event, which I have paid for? Not quite true. It's the researcher that's paying for it, but I get the point. Why would I not be invited to this event? Why is this not a common courtesy the way it is if I were a private donor? Now, it may very well be that in a lot of settings, there would be no perceived problem, and the corporate representative, the corporate donor, would be more than welcome to come in and talk to the researchers and find out what's going on. May very well not be problematic at all. But there may be cases in which it is. Now, I just raise this example for the very practical point of explaining how complicated the narratives can get and how touchy the situations can get. Something that looks like a simple, banal act of courtesy from a very reasonable perspective might actually look like undue influence or pressure or constraint from another equally reasonable perspective. Now, I don't know if there is a right perspective or a wrong perspective, but I do know that corporate funding of research in a university is just bound by its very nature to be a touchy subject. And so I think that we all have to be a little bit touchy about the way in which we handle these relationships, even when it comes to something as admittedly banal as a simple invitation to a representative of the corporation to show up at an event that's being organized under the umbrella of a given project. Now, turning to independence, I've left this to the second of my 2 points because I think it's fairly obvious. But let me make just a couple of practical points that I think could potentially be very useful to researchers. And again, these are implemented to a great extent as far as my experience shows. But first of all, what happens when the grant is up? So I think it's important in this context for practical, but also for more philosophical or even ideological reasons, for the term of the grant to be fixed, so that in 5 years you are done, or however many years. Or once you've spent down the funds, you are done. And if there is a renewal, which sometimes there is, then of course it needs to be extremely clearly communicated on what basis the renewal would not go forward. Because a researcher that is working with funds which he or she desperately needs in order to carry out his or her research is bound to feel, rightly or wrongly, a little bit of pressure if there is a potential for renewal looming. What does that mean? How is this request for renewal going to be taken? Should I feel some pressure to direct my research in one way rather than another? And even if I perceive no pressure as a researcher, how does this look to my community, to my interlocutors within the university community? How do my students look upon my research, my scholarly activities? How do my colleagues look upon them? Now, people who know me well would probably not be running around screaming that I'm engaged in all kinds of conflicts of interest, but they might be worried that I'm subject to undue pressure. They might be unhappy about a position that I have been put in. If I need to, or if I feel the need, or if I am perceived to feel the need to please my funders in order to obtain a renewal. Now, there's another way, I think, and again, a very practical way, to attenuate this potential difficulty. It may be a real difficulty, it may be a potential difficulty, it may be a perceived difficulty, but in any event, I think it's a difficulty that we have to take very seriously. The other possibility is to make sure that a researcher that receives corporate funding is not overly dependent on it. So that could mean that the amount of the funding is kept fairly low. It may be that only researchers that have other sources of funding, access to other sources of funding, will receive corporate monies. It may be that the university is willing to step in with a little bit of bridge funding if anything goes wrong, if the project is not renewed, so that the scholar feels no pressure and is not perceived to feel any pressure. And I think that these sorts of arrangements, now here I'm speaking both to my points about clarity and to my points about independence, these sort of arrangements are things that will probably make sense to absolutely everybody who's involved in these relationships. The corporation that's actually donating the money, potential donors, university, colleagues, the researcher, the wider community. I think these are fairly common sense approaches to take. Now I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about a different problem that is very closely related to the problem that I evoked when I discussed the difficulty of communicating the nature and the purpose of academic freedom. And that has to do not with corporate funding of researchers, but funding of universities more generally. And it has to do more in particular with this idea of usefulness, utility. And to the extent, it has to do with the extent to which the university can do what I think those of us in the university community believe it is we are supposed to do, namely contribute to knowledge. Not contribute to a particular purpose or objective in society, not contribute to the building of a better mousetrap, although we may do so along the way and so much better for us, but to contribute to the body of knowledge that is accessible to the broader society. Now, obviously, when it comes time to figuring out how to fund universities, the players are in a bit of a conundrum. University administrators who understand academic freedom very well also understand very well the need to keep the lights on, the need to keep the funds flowing, the need to make sure that that the infrastructure and the employees, the researchers, and the support for research can be paid for. And obviously this means, at some level, measuring outcomes, measuring effectiveness, finding out how universities are doing, metrics in short. And I don't need to tell you that the design of these metrics is very complicated. But we see, beyond the narrower question of corporate funding, we see in the larger question of university funding, problems regarding the way in which these metrics are being designed, the way in which they're being devised. We may be, as researchers, we're bound to be uncomfortable with any attempts to measure our usefulness. It makes us very touchy. But I think we do understand the need to do so. But how is that usefulness to be defined? How can we translate this mission of the university, contribution to knowledge, maintaining academic freedom, into a rubric or into a metric that makes sense from the point of view of which university or which unit in the university or which researcher in the university deserves more money or deserves less money? So I think that everything that I've said about the relationship between corporations and researchers can be mapped onto the broader relationship between the university and the variety of actors that contribute to our funding. This is an enormous problem which will never be solved to anybody's satisfaction, but I find as a university administrator myself, the trick seems to be to keep everybody a little bit unhappy, and that seems to work relatively well. Now, I want to turn to some things that I haven't said. First of all, why corporate funding for research? I haven't mentioned why. Well, I'll put my cards on the table, and this will come as no surprise to you because of the funding that I hold. I do think we need it. I do think we could use it. The various avenues for funding for universities are being constrained and shut down left, right, and center. I think it's important to figure out a way, if we can, to manage this particular relationship. And if we can't, well, then we need to look elsewhere, certainly. But I think that this is a source of funding that the university has to take very seriously. How am I getting on? I think things are going pretty well. I do what I want to do. I think that Hydro-Québec would probably conclude that it's quite useless, in all the right ways, of course, contribution to knowledge and so on and so forth. But I'm also very much aware that it's really not for me to judge, that this is an issue and a problem of perception, and that the issues and problems of perceptions are very real, and they are issues that I have to take very seriously. It doesn't much matter at the end of the day whether I am doing everything right, whether Hydro-Québec is doing everything right, whether the university is doing everything right. whenever there is a perception that of a problem, I think we all need to figure out how to address that perception. Would I do it again? I would say yes. If I were advising a younger scholar on this issue, I would probably encourage them to go forward, but with a few caveats. I've learned a few things, respecting in particular these ideas of clarity and independence that I mentioned before. I do have other sources of funding, but if this particular source were yanked out from under my feet tomorrow, it would not be trivial. That's certainly the case. And finally, could I convince you? If I were to put before you my body of scholarship, and more in particular, that tranche of the scholarship that's been funded by Hydro-Québec, would I be able to convince you that this relationship is all right, that it's relatively unproblematic, that you can be confident in me as a researcher, that you can be confident in the nature of my relationship with Hydro-Québec? Well, that is definitely not for me to judge, but I think that in my position, I have an obligation to make sure that I can always try to do that. And so one of the ways in which I suppose I can do that is to invite you to ask me any questions you might have. Thanks very much.
Questions, comments? You could come up to the microphone. Dr. Ottoman.
So thank you very much for that. I think you have to stand up because... Because I'm not tall enough to see you from there without standing up. So I thank you very much for that presentation. You've obviously thought very deeply about this, but only at the end did you get to the part that, as dean, that I'm concerned about, which is the rapidly vanishing availability of non-corporate, non-special interest funding for research in Canada.
Yeah.
Not just in Canada, but we're in Canada, so I'll pick on Canada for today. But all governments are pulling back dramatically, and they're also, at least in the case of the CIHR, which we in the Faculty of Medicine deal with primarily, are looking for more opportunities to partner with third parties, whether independent foundations or corporations or other. And that means that we no longer can promise young scholars who are beginning their careers that they'll be able to fund their careers entirely without corporate influence. Mm-hmm. So I didn't quite get, I think you laid out the problem, but I didn't quite get what the solution was. So maybe you could go into that a bit more.
Well, I think that the solution lies in the direction of thinking about the different ways in which corporations can provide funding to universities. So one of them, and I suspect it's probably among the most delicate, is the situation that I'm in, funding directly to a researcher. I've already told you that I think things are going pretty well, and I've also told you that I think that there are safeguards that can be put in place to make sure that these situations don't go the wrong way. But there are other things that are happening around the university that I know are very controversial: the naming of buildings, the naming of faculties, the naming of rooms, that kind of corporate sponsorship. It's much more visible, and therefore very controversial to the broader university community. My scholarship attracts very little attention from the broader community, so maybe that's actually a reason for the university to want to go in that direction and for the corporations to want to go in that direction. But I suppose the idea would be to find, to target the places in the university where funding could be received by the corporation with the least concern about conflict, undue influence, undue pressure, undue constraint.
Well, I have to say that the idea of corporations giving chairs, especially when the chairs do not come with any promise of doing anything for the corporation, is actually one of the better ways, because once the person's appointed, they're subject to the rules of the university and can do as they please. It's a much bigger problem when you come to operating funds, and going back to the previous session, it was quite clear that in the case of Dr. McDonald and in that whole period of time, it was almost an industry standard to accept money from corporations, and we can see that led to an enormous number of conflicts. Whichever side you stand on, point of view you may have, there's no question that the fact that the entire research program was funded by corporate interests creates enormous problems in terms of being able to interpret the data. Even if one concludes the data was done correctly, it's immediately suspect and casts an enormous shadow on the data. So I think that this problem is actually a very deep one, And it's not just at the level of how it influences directly the scholar, though frankly even there one could raise questions, but it's really in operating funds. It's trying to get the money to do your research. And for those scientists who have to do research in science or medicine or engineering or similar fields where you need a lot of money to do your project, it's a big issue.
I think that the chair is actually a pretty good example. Mine is not a chair; it's a little, it's a little bit different,
okay,
and it's time limited, which may create some kind of pressure. But I think the chair is about as close to a purely philanthropic donation as you can get, and I think that that does provide a higher level of guarantees.
There's a question there. If you could identify yourself.
Yeah, my name is Malcolm Olufsen. I'm an alumni. I'm not an academic. I'm semi-retired. And 2 points I want to mention. Any kind of research has its bias, and you have the terms of references which can influence the result. I'll give you an example, Champlain Bridge. You could have an academic at the civil engineering produce a study saying, yes, you've got to rebuild the bridge, and it's going to cost $3 billion. You could have another academic at another university do the same study and say, no, you can fix this bridge for much, much higher or lower cost. That's the first point. Second point, the funding, whether it's corporate or government, people now seem to think that, well, if it's corporate funding, it's very biased, and government funding is completely impartial.
Not at all.
Yeah.
So, it's nobody will question you these days if you say that corporate funding is biased. So it's easy for people to say now and get away with. One or two points.
Another comment. Please identify yourself.
I'm Jay's colleague in the Faculty of Law, Daniel Weinstock. Jay, one of the things that has always struck me, you know, in a very unsystematic way, it's not like I've done any, empirical studies about this, but I get the sense that universities sometimes sell themselves short in terms of the bargaining position that they're in relative to corporations. We provide, if corporations, if it was in their interest to do no business with us at all, they would set up their own labs, right? The fact that they are in these relationships with us suggests that it is better business for them to partner with universities than to set up their own institutions. Actually, some do set up their own institutions, but when they don't, it's because there's been some kind of cost-benefit analysis that suggests that they'd better get into bed with us than forget about the bed analogies. As someone who has been in the situation that you've been in, do you feel that that's right? That, in other words, that our institutions have a sort of adequate sense of the bargaining power that they have relative to corporations. My sense is that it perhaps isn't the case, that we see ourselves as perhaps weaker in the relationship than we actually are, and that might be part of the source of the problem. So, I guess in order to formulate this as a question, do you feel that in your position you have gotten the kind of pushback when needed, if the need ever arose, from the institution to say, well, wait a minute, you need us as much as we need you, and there are certain things that we are not going to stand for in this relationship. So I don't know if that resonates at all.
Well, with respect to the bargaining power, I think that's probably true. It's relatively easy for deans and chairs and professors to understand why a private donor would want to donate to McGill. I think that we have a certain amount of understanding about that. I think we're sometimes puzzled when corporate donors want to do so, and we usually assume that it's because they want us to be useful to them, and we want to resist that. So I think one of the things that can help enormously is for, again, and back to this communication theme, for the researcher to understand that the university is not on the back foot, that the university is not in a vulnerable position, that the researcher can be as bloody-minded as she wants to be about the parameters of the relationship. And as for pushback when I need it, absolutely. I think I've been very well taken care of. The university administration at the central level, at the decanal level in my faculty, my colleagues, including my colleagues who also hold this funding, have very much had my back. I've always felt that. I think in the law faculty, the sensitivity of our position is very well understood, and we understand it, and it's understood by our colleagues, so a good deal of care is taken there. But I can't say that I went into this with my eyes as wide open as I ought to have done. And I think that there were things that various levels of the university administration could have done to just set the stage for me a little bit and make me understand what the nature of this relationship.
Maybe I'll take the opportunity. I'd like to make one point. Maybe there are some corporations where we would not want to take money also. I mean, I would not want to be funded by the tobacco industry, for example. So I think that there has to be that thought. And for somebody like me who does drug safety research, I've had to sever all my contacts with the pharmaceutical industry because it was just, there was just too much conflict there and just too much dissonance. Like what they were saying and what they'd like and what I was doing. And so I think sometimes there isn't a solution. But there's got to be for most things because there's something called the Global Innovation Index. If you want to look Scientific American this month, and it shows this great correlation. The more universities collaborate with industry, the more innovative they are and the richer the country is. So I don't think it's something we can give up on. Are there any other comments? Yes, please.
Hi, Cameron Butler, MCSS Senator. You talked very much about the sort of different relationships between the corporations, university administration, and researchers. I was wondering what your thoughts were in terms of the role of students and where there becomes potential issues of corporate influence and pressure on researchers and how that may affect the education that they provide for students and what your thoughts on how to ensure that sort of there aren't issues of that in the classroom.
Well, I would say that the most immediate place where that arises is at the level of perception. My students they tend to come from a certain camp. They tend to be progressive. They tend to be environmentalists. They're often activists. They're members of movements. And the Hydro-Québec thing probably looks a little odd to them. No doubt it does. So I think that there's just a lot of work around communication with students that I need to do, but that the university also needs to do on our behalf to some extent, explaining to students how these relationships are worked out and how we are protected. If I look vulnerable from the point of view of my colleagues, I think I probably look very vulnerable from the point of view of my students. I think there is also this other question of funding directly to students, which is really interesting to explore. It's perhaps one of these relatively safe places to provide funding. If you simply give a grant to a student to cover tuition or to cover the cost of a year or two's education, that student is actually in a pretty safe position vis-a-vis the corporation. So I guess I would say that that students are not are probably less directly affected by corporate funding of research than they are by this other creep that I was beginning to refer to, this other metrics regarding the usefulness of university activities that may put certain kinds of pressure on us as teachers, on us as researchers, on us as administrators.
I just wanted to add a comment because you're not familiar. In the professional schools, especially in medicine, the influence of corporations on students is a huge problem. And there have been very good examples, or very bad examples, I guess is a better way to say it, of where curricula have been manipulated by corporations. The most recent one in the context, we're in the middle of the celebration of our pain center, and there are famous cases where companies would provide literature to lecturers to use to teach about pain, which essentially promoted certain methodologies that were good for the company and not necessarily the best. And that's unfortunately happened in Canadian universities. Nowadays, most Canadian medical schools are scrupulous in excluding any sort of a possibility of corporate influence. I'm not sure we get 100%, but we try our best. But you should be aware that certainly for people in those kind of professions, there is a very big issue beyond the one you just mentioned, which I agree with. There is a big issue that we work hard to try and get around. I'm not, you know, whether we succeed 100% or not, I don't know. But it is a it is an issue also even on, I believe, for undergraduates in terms of, you know, the some of the facilities and things that are made available for students often end up indirectly favoring one corporate interest over another. And I think one has to always be vigilant about those kind of things, even when one is aware of it. We know from literature about physicians who accept freebies, you know, things like pens and trivial little gifts from pharmaceutical companies, that you can show, as Pierre, I'm sure, can cite chapter and verse, you can show influence in the way the prescribing habits of those physicians, even though the physicians didn't necessarily get major material benefit. And in the old days, when they used to get free cruises and trips to Spain and so on, you can be sure it had an enormous influence on their prescribing habits and was a classic corporate tactic for manipulating the prescribing habits of physicians. So one should not underestimate the potential of influence of corporate interests in the university. It's a very big problem.
If there are no other comments, I think we are allowed a well-deserved, I think, coffee break. And how much time do we have, Joey? We have 15 minutes, and we'll be back. Thank you.